for possible stabbings at 16201 South Lincoln Highway, 16201 on Lincoln Highway. 17th state's landlord is killing her baby with a knife.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
Child death is always completely inconceivable. It's one of those things that I cover on my channel because it's something that just provokes something visceral and cerebral within me. The idea that anybody could harm a child is mind-blowing as far as I'm concerned and deserves the most serious consequences that could possibly be levied at any human being. And people give different reasons for killing children, from psychotic breaks to annihilation because they're angry with an ex, but it's rare that you hear about an individual killing somebody because of their political belief systems, particularly a child. Children are innocent beings. It doesn't matter who they are, where they're being brought up, what's going on around them. They are innocent beings. And yet still, it feels like some human beings are born with this predisposition for hatred. I genuinely don't believe that every single person can be groomed. I don't believe that every single person can have their minds changed because of the mass media and the belief systems of others. I genuinely think that some of us are just immune from that. I look back during COVID and I literally followed none of what I was told and absolutely went against everything that was pushed because I just knew it wasn't right. There was no humanity in it. So I believe that lots of us are like that. And the reality is that it wouldn't matter who was telling us what. What we were seeing in the press, we would never act in a way that could cause other human beings real harm. But today's case is one that's gonna do just that. And it's really complicated, guys, because it involves Israel and Gaza, the Palestinian versus the Jew. And I don't get involved in that stuff because aside from believing that every child has a right to life, I also see that right now in the Western world, particularly in the UK and America, there just seems to be this real intensification of hate. Hate towards Jews, hate towards people who are supporting the Palestinians. But the reason that I'm not going to get involved in that is I don't truly know enough about it. What I know is that something horrific happened October the 7th, and from that point onwards, Israel retaliated, and it is horrendous that people have died. And I know the historic points of it because I've bothered to read up on it. It's a very complex area, and I don't get myself invested and involved there because of the fact that it's not something that actually I deal with on a day-to-day basis here. And I don't think it's fair to start spouting my political beliefs because I don't think you can ever have them grounded in truth when you haven't understood the history and the experiences of either party. So this story is one that I'm talking about because it actually affected somebody in America. And it's actually happening more and more in places like America and the UK, where people are being harmed simply for belonging to a particular belief system, for example. But when it affects a child, I just think it's time for the world to take a breath because it's just incalculable that a child can die in such circumstances, but that's exactly what happens on the 14th of October 2023. A six-year-old little boy named Wadi Al-Fayoumi was stabbed 26 times in his own home, and he was just left to die in that state. And the reason for that is his landlord had started to believe that because his mother and the family were Palestinian, then the chances were that they needed to be eradicated. I mean, it just makes no sense even when I say that. But with respect, I think it's an important case to cover because no child should ever pay for a price for a war that they had no part in. And this is a child who was living in the States. So first of all, let's talk about Odai Al-Fayoumi. Odai never intended to actually live in the US. He was actually born in Jordan in 1989. Actually, he was a really successful interior designer. Now, when he's 26, he goes to Chicago, the Windy City, I believe it's known as, and he just loved it. He genuinely felt like this is the place I want to stay. And it's here that he meets a young Palestinian woman, Hanan Shaheen. And it's basically in this Facebook group for Arab Americans in Chicago. A bit like when people like me go over to Spain and you're looking for your expat community. It's really random how we do it, isn't it? It's like, humans are just humans, but you just kind of have that desire to meet people who shared a similar space to you in your world. So much like I would when I spend time, for example, in Italy a lot, I'm always involved in my local Bagni di Luca group because I just feel like there's a connection there with something I know. Likewise, they go on the Facebook group and they connect. Now, Hanan Shaheen, this is the mother and also one of the victims in this actual video. She was born and raised in Beitounia, which is a village outside Ramallah, which is in the West Bank. She had 9 siblings, so very big family. And her childhood was lovely. She lived on this idyllic farm. They apparently grew peaches and figs and tomatoes and olives. And would you ever need to leave the farm if you are growing such delicacies? You know, it just makes you think about a childhood that's very free and also the healthiness about the engagement in growing those types of foods. And neighbours came to the farm basically to buy from the family and they had enough to sustain themselves. And Anne said, there were no houses. Only a few in a large area, and you could only see trees. It was beautiful nature. We were literally surrounded by green. Now, after Hanan finishes high school, she goes on to become a primary school teacher. Her sisters actually married very young, which is quite culturally normal, but Hanan didn't want to. In fact, she had a real desire to prioritise her education. Now, when she turns 20, a Palestinian-American suitor from Chicago got her family's blessing and they were basically married quite quickly afterwards. Now, bear in mind, she was really happy in her village. I mean, it does sound like an absolutely delightful place to grow up, but she does actually relocate to Chicago in 2012 to get married. And within 2 years, they had 2 boys, Ishmael and Mohammed. Now, the marriage didn't actually last very long. After 4 years, Hanan asked for a divorce, and her main gripes in the relationship wasn't anything too aggressive, shall we say. He just worked a lot. He was out of the house most of the time, and she wanted a family. She wanted to be part of something greater than herself, being a childcare for her children. So she wanted to have that unit, and his lifestyle just made that impossible. Now, interestingly, he got custody of the children. So she only got to see them on the weekends. I can't imagine how intolerable that would be for anyone. But I also understand that I am not au fait with the cultural norms of Palestinian divorces and how that works out. I am very aware, for example, in the Hasidic Jew community, and I have a ton of friends who are not Hasidic Jews, by the way. They are Jewish. But I do appreciate that in the Hasidic Jew community, very often the man gets the children, even when there is absolutely nothing that the female has done in the relationship apart from wanting to leave. So it doesn't always work ultimately like the system I would know in my Western experience in the UK, which is 50-50 sharing of your children. I imagine just being a mother and only being able to see your kids occasionally, because it does feel very occasionally when you see them on the weekends, that must be really challenging. Now, shortly after she gets divorced, Hanan meets Adai on Facebook, and basically the relationship moves quite quickly. So within 1 year, they marry and they have a baby boy, Wadi Al-Fayoumi. Adai stated, life was not easy in America. He said, I rushed my decision to stay here. Originally, I was a tourist. I was just supposed to stay a really short period, go back home. But it is destiny. Nevertheless, my story is predestined. And I do appreciate that different cultures and belief systems have that mindset. So I don't know whether any of you know Amma, the hugging saints. Often people like Russell Brand will talk about Amma. Amma, her religious base is very much that the sins that you have suffered in your past lives will be dealt with in this life, and whatever happens to you is predestined and it's meant to happen to you. It's like a learning experience. And I've met Amma and I've been there and had a hug off her lovely hug, not going to deny it. But my belief systems are slightly different. I would say I'm very much more orientated towards the Christian faith. And really, I don't have a connection with any books, because I think that the moment that anybody touches a piece of paper with their own hands, bias is created, even when you're trying to be as neutral as possible. So I try to cut out the whole religious books that exist and just have a faith that is connected deeply with God. And everyone's different. Lots of people are atheistic in the UK. About 48% of people don't actually believe in anything. But for somebody like myself, I certainly feel that it's not predestined. I think that I'm here to learn lessons and to grow with those lessons and to find out what my story needs to learn and gather, so that when I finally have that moment taking my last breath, I have been a navigator of the world and a collector within the world and done my best to be the best I can be. I will fall short massively, but I've tried, if that makes sense. But I do understand that idea of being my story is predestined is very connected with lots of religions, in fact. Now, because his son was somebody he wanted to cherish massively, he called him Wade because he'd had this dream of doing that since he was a kid. His nickname growing up was Abu Wadi, and that translates to father of Wadi. And actually, that's because he'd always wanted the name Wadi. Now, rather than change it, he just said to himself, if I ever have a boy, I'm going to call him that name. Now, just like Hanan's previous relationship, she and Adai didn't actually last. And actually, just 2 months after their son was born, Hanan asked for a divorce. She said she was unhappy. She said that there just was a lack of romance within the relationship. She said, you cannot continue in this marriage. It wasn't written for us to continue as wife and husband. Now, the divorce process lasted between 3 and 4 years, but they actually managed to maintain a really good relationship, co-parenting. Apparently, they had a really deep friendship that was basically rooted in the love that they had for their beautiful boy. Now, their custody arrangement meant that Adai only got to spend 2 days out of every 2 weeks with Wade, which must have been very challenging for him because it clearly adored him. And he said, his mother usually brought him over to me at 9 in the morning. I would be sitting here on the chair looking outside the window to see him when he arrived. He said that the absolute distance between those visits was really difficult. He said, longing increases when I drive him back to his mother on Sunday. I feel like he's taking my heart with him. You become like a charger. Today you miss him a bit. Tomorrow you miss him more, and so on. By the time of the next visitation, I'm totally out of charge. I must see him. And as soon as I see him, even only for 5 minutes, I feel much better. Now, Adai stayed in Chicago because he basically wanted his son to have better opportunities later in life. He said, in Jordan, it wouldn't be surprising to find that your taxi driver has earned a high academic degree. He might be a doctor. There are many doctors, but there are very few jobs and low salaries. My life perspectives have changed drastically. His future is what made me stay in America, where I came as a tourist. And I think that so many of us can relate to that. You sacrifice your own needs a great deal for your children because you're a loving parent, and the future for them is everything that we consider. So even if you've got family in other areas of the world, even if you might have an easier life elsewhere, the idea of making sure your child has every opportunity that you could dream of for them, that's a real connector to the place that you live. Now, Adai lived in Bridgeview. It's a moderately sized village. It's about 45 minutes outside of Chicago. It's actually known locally as Little Palestine. So I would imagine that that means that there are a lot of people from the area of the world who all live there and share space, probably can get all the nice foods that they eat. And the language is probably very, very present. And I guess it makes people feel very connected, both to the state that they're in within the American world, but also the state that they're in when they're living back at home. Now, one of the things that needs to occur for Hanan is she needs to find work and she needs to find a place to stay. So she ends up moving in with somebody called Chuba. So she becomes a caregiver for senior citizens. She moves around a lot. She's always looking for more affordable living situations because it's really expensive these days to live, full stop. And in 2021, Adai helps her to find a new flat for herself and for their son in Plainfield. Now, Plainfield Township is located in Weld County, Illinois. It's around 40 minutes from Chicago. So Hannan and Wadi, they rent two rooms in a property owned by Joseph Tuber. And he also lives with his wife, Mary. So they are basically sharing a kitchen and a living room, and you need to pass through to access their private space, which includes two small bedrooms, a kitchenette and a bathroom. But it's perfectly acceptable and reasonable for them to live there. And initially, they got on really well. All four tenants of the house have got a good relationship. They interacted every day. Wadi even referred to Tuba and Mary as grandpa and grandma. I mean, that in itself demonstrates a really intensely close relationship. For Tuba and Mary to be called grandpa and grandma, and it really denotes that kind of special innocence and naivety of children, where they don't really care about blood. They care about the way you treat them. They care about what you represent. And Tuba and Mary must have represented something safe and something special and connected and loving, at least initially. Adai actually described Tuba as being one of those people who tended to look a bit rough and disheveled, but over time, he just became really easy around him. He felt like they got on really well. And just to put this into context, as far as the closeness of the relationship was, Tuba actually collected scrap wood. He'd make tables and chairs for Wadi to play with. He even made a treehouse and a swing, which is delightful. He put so much effort into making the garden child-friendly and just interesting for Wadi. And when Adai asked him, why are you doing this? He said, for the boy to play and be happy. Tuba and Wadi apparently always played together as well. So, I mean, this isn't just a tenancy arrangement. This feels like a family arrangement. Now, Tuba is 71 year old at the time of the attack, so he fits perfectly their grandpa paradigm, doesn't he? What can I say about him? You know, he lived a really quiet life in the semi-rural outskirts of Plainfield. He was a US Air Force veteran, so he protected and served his country. And records showed that he and his wife raised a family. I don't have the info of their family, but they'd obviously been together a long time, decades. And they lived a really pro-social life. Now, in 2023, what I would say is that the people who knew Tuba, they felt that there was a change within him. First of all, he starts to become obsessed with the news of the war in Gaza. And at this point, he starts really voicing alarmist theories. He actually starts listening to, I suppose, what some would consider a right-wing radio programs that often decry Islamic extremism. And hey, I decry Islamic extremism. I mean, I don't think there's anything right-wing about saying that Islamic extremism is horrific and a blight on humanity. But equally, you see that as a minority of individuals, not a majority, and you don't get swayed into this belief system that every practicing Muslim is thinking about jihad, for example. But it seems like he's going through, shall we say, some kind of change in his psyche, and those kind of belief systems are being amplified within him. And in certain people, as we know, because of fundamentalists in all different areas, it's as if a part of their brain just starts hearing all of the absolute extremes as opposed to the norms and making those extremes the norms. Now, we all know what happened on October the 7th, 2023. I have no problem in saying that Hamas is a terrorist organization, albeit one that was revered to some degree in Palestine by many, many citizens, and they are despicable. Hamas are despicable. They need to be removed from this earth. I wish that God's hands could strike them down. They are despicable individuals. I have no problem saying that. What happened on October the 7th is harrowing beyond belief. But it blows my mind that these days, these moments, seem to serve as a political whipping point for so many people who are not anywhere near the conflict. And I think that the anger that these kind of things provoke can often spill out into belief systems that are not based in reality. But nonetheless, let's be clear, we condemn everything that happened on the 7th of October 2023 to those poor Jewish people. Now, Tuba gets absolutely fixated on the fact that it might spill over into American life. And of course, we know that these things do spill over. Like, I live in the UK, without a shadow of a doubt, we've had massive terrorist attacks here. We have 50,000 on the terror watch list in the UK. We've just recently had quite a few terrorists basically caught who are planning major terrorist attacks in the UK. So of course, things do spill over. But you also have to remind yourself that, again, that is a tiny minority of people. Now, it turns out that in particular, he became fixated with this online conspiracy that a so-called National Day of Jihad had been declared for the 13th of October 2023. Now, that just turned out to be a baseless rumour that was just circulating on social media that month. And we know that every single month there's some kind of crazy thing circulating on social media, but he kind of buys into it. And he says to his wife at this point that he's starting to fear Hanan and her friends. By the way, Hanan and her friends have done absolutely nothing to provoke this fear. They're just as lovely as they have been prior to this moment. Now, Mary is really struggling because she doesn't have a problem with any of them. And she's just calming him down. She's saying, our tenants are lovely, peaceful, working people. And also, bear in mind, he's got this really close connection with this beautiful little boy. Now, in an act of what I suppose we could describe as survivalist panic, Tuba actually goes to the bank and withdraws $1,000 in case the grid went down. Now, don't get me wrong, I appreciate there is a survivalist mentality and I appreciate that there are fears and anxieties that people genuinely hold because the powers that be are so untrustworthy. I do not believe that people who are survivalists, who dig bunkers, I do not think they're mad, and I'll tell you why. Because Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and a whole heap of the other uber rich, they have them too. So if they have them, why does it mean that people are mad when ordinary human beings go out and actually worry about this stuff? It's a top-down issue and not an insanity issue. But you can kind of see that there's something going on within Tuba's psyche and mentality that he's actually taking these kind of lengths to ensure that he feels safe, in spite of the fact that literally there is no one within his personal experience who is threatening him in any way. Now, the morning of Saturday, the 14th of October, 2023, Hanan and Wadi are just at home. Actually, they'd planned to head out around midday. They wanted to pick up Hanan's other two children because obviously she has two exes and she wants to bring them all together. Now, around 11:30 a.m., Hanan's just undressing Wadi. She's going to get him a shower. Tuba knocks at the door. Now, of course, she doesn't have a problem answering the door to Tuba. This is a guy who's literally built tables and chairs and a treehouse for her son. Hanan answers and all of a sudden, from out of nowhere, Tuba's yelling at her. He's screaming at her about what was happening in Jerusalem and demanding to know why she wasn't doing anything to stop the war in Gaza. I mean, that's like knocking on my door right now and doing the same. It's like knocking on my door and saying, you're Christian, why aren't you going and doing anything to help those poor Christians in Sudan who are getting murdered and burned in churches? Because I don't have a clue how to. I just don't know what power I would have. I don't have any political strength there. You know, how do you deal with something like that? It's like somebody stereotyping you immediately and then giving you this level of power that you don't even have. Now, she says, rightfully so, she prays for peace, but it just doesn't hit him in any meaningful way. And before she can say anything, Tuba just lunges at her, grabs her by the neck, and he's strangling Hanan in the doorway. And apparently he was reportedly shouting, you Muslims must die. I mean, it is mind-blowing that he can go from knowing this woman and her beautiful child, and now she's a Muslim that must die. Now, Hanan at this point is just trying to reason with Tuba. Even as she's being choked, she's saying, let's give peace a chance. But he doesn't want to listen. He forces his way into the house. He throws Hanan to the floor. And then from a sheath on his belt, he pulls out a large military style knife. It's got a serrated 7-inch blade. Guys, you know how dangerous those things are. He pins Hanan beneath him. This is ex-military man. She doesn't stand a chance. He's older, but he's so much more dominant physically. Tuba stabs her 12 times in total. She took blows to her chest, her torso, her limbs, her face. In fact, at one point, he smashes the handle of the knife into Hanan's face, trying to break her teeth. Despite those horrific life-threatening injuries, she's fighting back, she's being brave, she's got tenacity, she's refusing to go down, and she claws at Tuba's face. She manages to actually scratch his forehead and cheek. She's screaming to him, "Let me go to hospital." She's pleading with Tuba to stop, but he refused. The attack just left her completely immobilized on the ground. When Tuba stops stabbing her, because probably he believes he's done enough to kill her, she manages to run down the hall to the bathroom. She locks a door behind her. She's panicked, she's bleeding profusely, and she's aware that her son is now by himself with this murderous predator. She frantically dials 911 at 11:38 a.m. She's shouting down the phone for help. She's saying a landlord's attacking her, and parts of the call were actually played at the trial, where Hanan can be heard saying, "The landlord is killing me and my baby." While Hanan was barricaded in the bathroom, bleeding out, calling for help, clinging on for life, Tuba turned his attention to gorgeous little six-year-old Wade. He was lightly caught by Tuba as he tried to hide. Tuba then stabbed the little boy that he'd made furniture for, that he created a treehouse for, that he'd played with, that he was referred to as Grandpa by, and he stabbed him 26 times. He inflicted really deep wounds on his chest and his abdomen. Bear in mind the size of that knife and the slight size of this child. The wounds are catastrophic. Hanan had remained on the phone with 911, and all she could hear were her son's terrified screams during the attack. She was so weak, she'd lost so much blood. There was nothing that she could do apart from urge the operator to send help. Now, please, now. At 11:45 a.m, the police arrived, the first officers at the scene. Wadi's just lying on the bedroom floor. He's in a pool of blood, he's unconscious. He's really gravely injured. Her nan emerges from the bathroom when she hears the officers shout their arrival. Somehow, and honestly how she did this, no one knows, she remained conscious throughout. Responders at this point said that she just looked like she was in absolute shock. She was trembling. She was kind of staring in a daze as she just pointed them to her beautiful boy. She told the police she'd found her son on the ground with a knife still lodged in his abdomen. Paramedics then have to transport them both to Ascension St. Joseph Medical Centre in the nearby Joualet. At this point, Wadi is still alive, but you can imagine that his condition is absolutely catastrophic. He's in such a bad way. Now, while her nan was being treated, she gave the nurse Tuba's wife's phone number, asked them to call to explain what had happened so she wouldn't come back to a bloody scene and be surprised. I mean, what does that tell you about Hanan? She's just been mutilated, brutalized, all but murdered. Her son is dying. There's no other way than to describe it that way. And she is concerned about Tuba's wife walking into something so heinous that she won't be prepared for it. She's thinking about other people in that moment. Also, she's desperately trying to get across what she wants to happen in case she dies and who she wants to take care of, her son, etc. But that's never going to be necessary, because shortly after, she is told that Wade didn't survive the horrific wounds. At this point, she's taken into surgery because there's a hell of a lot of work to do. She has to have a repair of a collapsed lung. She's got deep lacerations everywhere. But against all the odds, Hanan survives. Albeit she survives in the knowledge that her baby is never going to see her again in this life. It doesn't take the police long for Tuba to be arrested. He's outside his home. He's apparently just sitting on the ground. He's got his hands and clothes soaked in blood. And the officers said the one thing that we noted was that he was really profusely sweating, but there was also this eerie calmness about him. He didn't resist arrest. And he just had this really vacant look on his face. He gets quickly handcuffed. He doesn't protest his arrest. He's then taken to the Will County Jail. He didn't even say a word. And understandably, one of the officers said, "Why would you do this?" But he didn't respond. Now, the next day, Tuba was charged with first-degree murder, attempted first degree murder, aggravated battery with a deadly weapon, and two counts of committing a hate crime. On the 16th of October 2023, they brought Chuba before a judge for an initial hearing. He was denied bail, understandably, because that kind of murderous rampage demonstrates an inability to walk the streets safely. And actually, Illinois had eliminated cash bail for more serious crimes by 2023, so there's no way he was going to get bond. Now, at the hearing, Chuba literally only spoke to confirm his name. And guess what he said? He said he was not guilty. He was not guilty. I mean, you've got a first-person witness who was literally nearly stabbed to death by him. You've got a child that ultimately everyone knows was killed by him. And yet he's saying he's not guilty. What does that speak about this man? Is it because he feels there is a justification in the killing? Is he confusing his time in the forces and he's seen this individual as the enemy and therefore he doesn't think his actions require any kind of formal legal process? Is it that there is something within his psyche that is slipping? I don't know. But it's very strange to enter a not guilty plea when it's so blindsidingly obvious what he did. Now, at this point, a public defender is appointed to represent him, and the FBI actually quickly become involved in the case. Now, US Attorney General Merrick Garland, they actually announced that the Department of Justice had opened a federal hate crime investigation into the murder of Wadi and the attempted murder of Hanan. And of course, because from the man's own mouth, he was saying that basically he was doing this because he thought she wasn't doing enough to stop what was happening in Gaza. Now, the FBI Chicago's field officer joined the case and said that the investigation of hate crimes need to be taken extremely seriously, of course. He said the reason for the parallel inquiries were to determine if Chuba violated federal hate crime statutes, and that could lead to federal charges on top of state charges. Now, going back to Hannah, bear in mind how brutally attacked she'd been. Her injuries were horrific. So one stab wound punctured her lung, another narrowly missed a major artery. She had bruising on her neck and face. She'd been strangled. She'd been beaten. And by the 18th of October, this is after she had gone under emergency surgery, she was downgraded from critical to serious. So at this point, she was conscious. She was able to speak with her family. She had about 10 days in hospital. And at this point, she's discharged. But she hasn't got a home to go to anymore. So she hasn't got her little boy with her. And instead, she's now isolated, living out of hotels for several weeks. I can't even imagine the psychological devastation and trauma she would be going through in that situation. Bear in mind, her major family are back home. So she hasn't got that natural support network and foundation. And she's in pain. She has to undergo serious physical therapy for her injuries. She's been left with scars across her chest, across her arms. And even simple tasks in those early days, like raising her left arm or taking deep breaths, they were almost impossible. Now, the Chicago area Muslim community rallied around her. So the community could see that she was struggling and understood her horrific loss. And so loads of volunteers brought meals. There was actually a fundraiser collected. There were donations to assist with her medical bills and Wadi's funeral expenses. I actually find it really shocking that victims of crime have to pay medical bills in America. I know that I live in the UK where there's the NHS. We pay for it differently. We do pay for it. Everybody says it's free. It's not free. You know, I pay a lot of tax, so it's not free. But because you do it before you need treatment, understandably, you're not faced with those bills when you exit treatment. The idea that your son can be murdered and you can be all but stabbed to death and you've got to pay a bill for it just seems a little bit bizarre to me. Now, reportedly, over $300,000 was raised via Launch Good. That's a Muslim-focused crowdfunding site, and that was to help Hanan relocate to a new home, but also to just honour Wadi's memory through charitable causes. Now, very sadly, because Wadi had died, obviously a funeral ensued, and that happened on the 16th of October 2023. It took place at the Mosque Foundation in Bridgeview. Adai was there. He actually performed the ritual of washing Wadi's body himself. Hundreds attended. They just wanted to pay their respects and to give that really powerful message to the family that they weren't alone. Adai actually spoke in Arabic at the funeral and said his son is a martyr whose death symbolizes the killings of Palestinians in Gaza. I mean, I think it demonstrates both because children have been killed as far as the Jewish community are concerned as well. I think this is about children being murdered in war, because that's what we're talking about from both sides, war, and these children are innocent. Also said that while Muslims and Palestinians are often portrayed as terrorists or violent, his son was a victim of hatred, without a shadow of a doubt, goes without saying. Now, unfortunately, and I think devastatingly personally, Hanan was still in hospital. She couldn't actually attend her son's funeral. She had to watch it via a video call because that was stolen from her as well. Now, on the 24th of February 2025 in Juliet, Illinois, Judge Amy Batani Tomczak was the person presiding over the case. The prosecution was run by Wills County State Attorney James Glasgow and their Assistant State's Attorney Michael Fitzgerald. And the defence was led by George Leonard and Kylie Blatty. They were public defenders. Now, the prosecution, I mean, with respect, I think they've got quite a slam dunk case, haven't they? I mean, they've got a first person witness, and that's the first person that's called too, which is, of course, Hanan Shaheen. Now, she spoke in English, but she did have an Arabic interpreter on standby when needed, and she was able to just recount the entire attack for the jurors, from Tuba's initial knock on their door to strangling her to shouting, "You as a Muslim must die." They also played that 911 call, and obviously that just adds to the incredibly emotional testimony that was going on. Now, on cross-examination, the defence basically attempted to illustrate that nobody actually saw the moment Wadi was stabbed. I mean, how does that even make sense? Do you know what? Sometimes I think that defence, they are clutching at straws and they don't really have a case to defend because it's so obvious he's guilty. But it kind of pisses me off that what they'll do is say, well, nobody actually saw Wadi being stabbed by the guy who just stabbed his mother. Maybe somebody else ran in and stabbed him in some kind of really weird coincidental attack. I mean, come on. But that's what they're saying. Like, well, nobody saw Wadi get stabbed. You know, Hanan was in the bathroom. So can we say that he stabbed the child? Why was she in the bathroom? Maybe she wanted to wash her face. Now, why was she in the bathroom? She had a few scratches. Was she in the bathroom because she'd been stabbed many times by the man who's on the stand? Maybe. And you're suggesting that in that attack, he didn't then kill the child. Instead, he left, somebody else came in, and then they did that. I'm saying that could have happened. It's a possibility. We just don't know. You know, it's just ludicrous. Anyway, they go on to probe her memory on like minor details. So they say, you know, you don't remember these minor details because, you know, after you've been stabbed by the perpetrator who's in this court, you know, you couldn't remember everything perfectly. Listen, I can't remember everything perfectly on a 5-minute basis. There are things that happen in my life moments before.
From ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast, this is Murder at the U.
Did you say someone got shot?
November 2006, a college football star on his way to NFL dreams, gunned down in broad daylight.
Just bawling, crying, and he said, "Coach, they killed him."
No weapon, missing witnesses, conflicting accounts, and for years, no arrest.
She insinuated that the Miami PD had done nothing, and it became a little bit more accusatory.
The case goes cold, rumors spread, and the truth gets buried. Until now.
His world could come crashing down. According to him, it was over.
The ending, something no one saw coming. Because this story isn't over yet. From ESPN's 30 for 30 podcast, this is Murder at the U. Binge the full season right now, wherever you get your podcasts.
And I've already forgotten them. And then when somebody reminds me that I had to do it, I genuinely think they were making it up until I realised I do have to do it. It's ludicrous, the idea that you've got to have this perfect picture memory for what you're telling to be taken seriously. Now, Hanan did need to rely on translation from the Arabic interpreter for most of the defence questions, and it was clear at times that she wasn't exactly sure of what she was being asked, which is unsurprising anyway, because if you go into court and you listen to court cases, often you don't have a clue what the defenders or prosecutors are asking you because they use really weird language. So it's going to be even more difficult when you've not got your first spoken language as a language that they speak. Now, the jurors, they were also shown really graphic photos. They were shown body cam footage from the scene. These included images of blood-splattered floors and walls in the home. They showed them the knife that was used in the attack, the pictures of both Wadi and Hanan's injuries. And obviously, some of the photographs were unbelievably gruesome. Just imagine being a juror and you're presented with Wadi's small body with just loads of stab wounds. In fact, the judge ordered the courtroom had screens that meant that they turned away from the public gallery whilst the jury saw them, because the judge was obviously very aware of the traumatisation that that could cause. Now, one body cam video actually showed the moment an officer discovered Wadi's body and shouted, "Oh God," because they are human. You know, I often think that people categorise police officers and first responders as their careers, and we forget that there is a human being that inhabits that body. There are fathers and mothers, you know, people who are absolutely devoted to children. And to come across a six-year-old little boy's brutalised body, clinging onto life because of these enormous injuries he's received, you can just imagine that entirely human reaction. Oh God. The jury also was shown the knife itself and how it was carefully removed from Wadi's abdomen in hospital, because as his mother had said when she found him, it was just sticking out of him. Also, the blood on Shuba's clothes and body, that was confirmed to belong to Hanan and Wadi. Then there were the medical witnesses who were brought in. So paramedics confirmed that little boy suffered 26 stab wounds and he had no pulse when they arrived. A trauma surgeon came and detailed how Hanan's injuries were so horrific that she was really close to death. Deputy Victoria Genovac, they found Wadi, and when she was on the stand, she just lost it. She was just choking back on tears. She said, "That image of that little boy with those wounds, they're gonna haunt me forever." Then we had Officer Sean Kozak. He actually saw Hanan at the scene. He said she just seemed so shocked, so quiet. She was trembling and sort of staring, and she was just covered in blood and in utter distress. Now, the prosecution called Chuba's now ex-wife, because that woman had divorced him because she was not involved in this whatsoever. As she said, she saw her tenants as peaceful, loving human beings. She tried to get him to see it that way as well. This was nothing to do with her. She's now called Mary Connor. She told the jury that in the days before the attack, she really did notice that her husband's behaviour had changed dramatically. She said he just became utterly outraged at the events of October the 7th, 2023. He started to insist that Hanan has to move out. He said, her friends could come and do us harm. And she said, all I did was just say, this is ridiculous. You know, there's nothing about these people that pose any threat to us. You're overreacting. But it didn't calm him. He just remained really angry. So that demonstrates premeditation that's rooted in Islamophobia, because he's got this mindset that he's amplifying against these individuals living with him because of their belief system. Mary also confirmed that right up until that point, they genuinely had a really good relationship with Hanan and Wadi, so it just didn't make sense to her. And bear in mind, this is a man who in his life with his partner hasn't been some kind of horrific predator. He's not some violent man with this horrendous intent. This isn't a normal way of him being and acting. So his wife doesn't know what to do with this, because this seems like very distinct from who he actually is typically. And even though he's not going to have an insanity plea in this, and I don't believe he was fully insane during this attack, I do wonder whether there was some kind of sliding between reality and fantasy, and that he was getting captured. I'm not saying that he was having a psychotic episode completely. I'm saying that he was growing more suspicious and paranoid, which are certainly the precursors for those kind of mental states. Now, when it comes down to the defense, well, like I've already said, it wasn't very strong at all. I don't really think they had a case to fight. Now, Chuba didn't take the stand on his own, so he didn't try to defend himself. But what the defense did was they basically tried to put holes in the story. They were like, nobody witnessed what he's stabbing, as if you need somebody to witness people being murdered for that to go. Could you imagine the rules on how to get away with murder how do I get away with murder? Well, all you need to do is you just need to kill somebody when they're by themselves and there's no CCTV. And then even if you're seen, you know, walking away, covered in blood, carrying a weapon, the reality is that's just coincidence. Somebody else could have popped in the interim and murdered the victim themselves, so we can't try you in court. Can you imagine how many people would end up dead, literally? Like, that would be a serial killer's wet dream, wouldn't it? So the defence is using this, but it makes no sense whatsoever. So they kind of alluded to the idea that, you know, maybe there was an argument. Maybe they had a bit of an argument, and that was kind of something that set this in motion. You know, there's a chain of causation to this six-year-old child being stabbed 26 times. I mean, literally makes no sense. I mean, even if there was an argument, which there wasn't, between the perpetrator and the victims in this case, it still wouldn't explain why a child ended up in such a horrendous way, because a child is innocent of those arguments. So it's clear they're grasping at straws. There's no alternative suspect. There's no justification. There's no ambiguity about Wadi's cause of death whatsoever. And the defence even conceded that Chuba caused the victim's injuries. So they admit he did it. They're just not admitting why he did it. Now, they didn't pursue an insanity defence, and they actually presented no expert psychiatric testimony, which really surprises me. I think it would have been really important to bring in an expert psychiatrist, because, you know, there may have been some kind of slippage. Equally, they may not have brought in an expert psychiatric testimony, because who knows, they might have asked for one and it might not have looked good for their clients. Now, when it comes down to the closing arguments, they take place on the 28th of February 2025, and Fitzgerald reminded the jurors of just how small and just how innocent Wadi was. They had removed the evidence tags from the knife Chuba used, and Fitzgerald held it up in front of the jury, repeated the phrase 26 times for each stab wound. He said he couldn't escape. It wasn't enough that this defendant killed that little boy. He left the knife in the little boy's body. Now, the defence, they urged the jury not to let sympathy cloud their judgment. Sorry. What a ridiculous thing to say. Jury, don't let sympathy get in your way of judgment. Don't be sympathetic. Don't be sympathetic. Avoid sympathy. Avoid that natural human reaction. Same with empathy. Ignore sympathy, ignore empathy, ignore compassion, ideally ignore truth. But just ignore all that. And just do this in a very black and white type of form. Yeah, I think even if we got rid of all the human emotions, we're still clearly going to see that your client stabbed a child 26 times. Well, did they? Yes, yeah, did they though? Yes. Did you see it? No, exactly. So get rid of sympathy, compassion, empathy, logic, sense, and then you may find yourself, I don't know, a little bit confused, a little bit of reasonable. Why are you all shaking your heads? Why are you all looking at me and shaking your heads? Why are you tutting at me? Honestly, it drives me mad. How can they get rid of sympathy? They're a jury. They're meant to feel those things. That's how they apply the law to the feelings that are provoked from the evidence presented. Now, Blatty argued that the case was circumstantial. It's circumstantial. Is it circumstantial? Yes, it is. Why? Well, because there are just all these circumstances, aren't there? So if you're thinking about the word circumstance and just add a few letters and say circumstantial, then maybe you should find my client innocent. I kid you not, guys. I kid you not. They even went on to say that the state had not proved beyond reasonable doubt that Chuba had premeditated his attack. Apparently, it was just a moment of confusion. You know, just one of those moments of confusion. You walk into the shops, you're thinking to yourself, what did I put on my shopping list? Bread, beans, I've forgotten. Right, I'm just going to stab somebody many times because I'm in a confused state, and that will give me reasonable doubt in a court of law when I'm charged with their murder and tried for it. Because, you know, these things happen when you're a bit confused. I mean, do me a favour, mate. The 28th of February 2025. You know that jury you were told, don't be sympathetic. Don't actually listen to any of what we've given in evidence. No, no, no. Just accept that we don't know who killed the child. Yeah, it took them 90 minutes. 90 minutes. I mean, genuinely, when it's 90 minutes, they may as well have just taken 1 minute because we know they'd already made the decision. They returned a unanimous guilty verdict on all counts. And a juror actually later told the press the facts were just overwhelming. We all knew what the right verdict was almost immediately. So at the sentencing on the 2nd of May 2025, Judge Amy Batani-Tomczak, they sentenced Tuba to 53 years in prison. This was 30 years for first degree murder, 20 years for attempted murder, also additional 3 for the hate crime enhancement. Now in Illinois, the first degree murder convicts have to serve 100% of their sentence. There's no early release. So this means that even with really good behaviour, Tuba would actually be well over 100 years old before he could be released, which makes this a life sentence. And with respect, you stab a child to death 26 times, rot in hell. Simple as that. Rot in hell. Now, Tuba's defence did file post-trial motions in an effort to negate his conviction. They were optimistic, weren't they? They argued that the prosecution had inflamed the jury's emotion with graphic evidence. Sorry. Yeah, they inflamed the jury's emotion. What did they inflame it with? The evidence. Isn't that what a jury's meant to do? Yeah. Yeah, but we're saying, you know, at the end of the day, it inflamed it too much. Yeah, you probably need to go and think about getting a new career. Anyway, the motions were very quickly and swiftly denied. The defence had indicated that they will appeal the verdict with the Illinois Appellate Court. This could take years, and with respect, with the information and evidence you got, kid, I wouldn't waste your time. Now, on the 21st of November 2023, Adai filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Tuba, also against his ex-wife and their management company. I actually feel sorry for his ex-wife, with respect. He claimed that they were indifferent and failed to recognise a threat and prevent serious bodily harm. So he wants financial compensation for Wadi's death. Now, in June 2024, Hanan filed a similar wrongful death lawsuit against the same parties as well as Tuba's brother. So she alleged that his brother worked in real estate and introduced the rental opportunity to them, despite being in a position where he ought to have known about Tuba's prejudices. Hanan is actually represented by Ben Crump, who's a prominent civil rights lawyer. I have to say, I kind of don't feel that the brother is guilty in this. I genuinely don't. Or the wife, now ex-wife, because obviously this was new information. You can see that because his ex-wife said that it was only in the days leading up to this horrendous attack that she was hearing him speak this way and she was challenging him on it. And so I'm not sure what more she could have done. She didn't think he had the potential to kill a child and so nearly kill a woman. And the person who introduced her to that living condition, well, that brother wouldn't have known because we're talking about Tuba actually making furniture for Wadi and playing with him constantly and being like a grandpa to him. So those underlying belief systems and feelings, they certainly weren't at the surface if he even held them when he first met them. But this is the way it goes. And whilst money will never bring that child back, I guess it could ease the lives of the parents. Now, when it came down to the public and political responses, well, obviously there was a massive provocation. There was an outpouring of grief and outrage across the country from all walks of life. Will County Sheriff Mike Kelly said, "Every single person deserves to feel safe in their own home. This family did nothing wrong. Their only sin in the eyes of that suspect was being Muslim. And for that, a beautiful little boy is dead. It's abhorrent." FBI Director Christopher Wray, he later cited Wadi's case in congressional testimony as an example of all the dangers of hate violence in volatile times. President Joe Biden issued a statement. I say President Joe Biden, I mean, somebody wrote one for him because let's be honest, he was in a state of cognitive decline. But somebody who was probably running the country at the time issued a statement on the 15th of October 2023, rightly called the act a horrific hate crime, said Jill and I were sickened to learn of the brutal murder of a child and the attempted murder of the child's mother at their home in Illinois. Biden apparently personally spoke with Adai on the phone and said that Biden was very emotional. So he called him crying, telling me about the son that he lost, because obviously President Biden lost a son to really serious cancer, so he understands the loss of a child. Now, Biden assured Wadi's family that there is no place for hate in America. Well, I mean, there's a place for hate in every country. It exists, you know. You can say there's no place for it, but it happens and it is in every single walk of life. It's as simple as that. But he reckoned that he was going to do everything in his power to combat Islamophobia and hate-based violence. And I guess that it's strange that he did that pretty much on the same day that he reaffirmed the US support for Israel's military action in Gaza. So I guess for somebody like Odai, that probably just feels like empty promises. And like I said, I'm not getting involved in the war, etc. I'm just saying that if you're telling a parent who's lost a child because of this apparent extremist view, and then you're sending money to continue children being killed in awful circumstances, that must be kind of hard for somebody to understand when it comes down to the authenticity of your sentiments. Now, activists, including Odai, while appreciating his sympathy on a personal level, have actually called him out for those double standards. Like I said, I'm not coming down on the understanding of what's playing out in Israel, etc. War is always awful. Equally, so is terrorism. It's as simple as that. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, he was unequivocal in his condemnation of Tube. He said to take a six-year-old child's life in the name of bigotry is nothing short of evil. And he called Wadi's murder a hate crime, plain and simple, which it is. Then Pritzker, a Jewish American, made a point to say that the entire population of Illinois, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, or otherwise, deserve to live free from the threat of such evil. Said Wadi should be heading to school in the morning. Instead, his parents will wake up without their son. The governor actually attended Wadi's funeral, met privately as well with Hanan while she was in hospital, and also brought her flowers. I think what was stressed by the vast majority of followers was that Wadi had suffered without having any understanding as to what was going on in the wider world that he was basically made to pay for. He wasn't involved in any conflict. He was just a six-year-old kid going about his business. And it's terrifying to imagine that somebody can punish this child when they don't even know what they're being punished for. The media coverage in this case was enormous. It was featured in newspapers worldwide, from the New York Times to the BBC to Al Jazeera. And a lot of those actually pinned it as an anti-Muslim hate crime. In fact, the Chicago Sun-Times and Tribune, they put Wadi's photo on the front pages, and their editorial boards wrote, "There is no straight line from hateful rhetoric to hateful violence." So that media commentary is basically pointing out that really painful irony that a child whose family fled from the Middle East ended up the victim of violence in America because of the same conflict. And so basically journalists were asking the public to reflect on how rhetoric has the power to radicalise individuals like Tuba. And the reality is, it's absolutely devastating, isn't it? It's just devastating that this beautiful little boy could end up in this situation where he is seen as a figure that is requiring of destruction because somebody has radicalised themselves online about a war that this child is not even aware of. Isn't that just absolutely horrific? Hamas is a diabolical militant terrorist group, but equally, children being blown up in Gaza, that's a blight on our humanity too. I feel like right now in our world, there are so many wrongs. In Sudan, for example, as I was talking about earlier on, so many wrongs. And the people in power, they're all the same. It's all about money. It's all about power. It's all about control. And then there is this collateral damage, human life, children, babies, women being raped, murdered. This all stems from that global desire for supremacy, whether religious supremacy or financial supremacy. And the hate crimes in the UK and the States that are happening at the moment in the name of these wars is just blindsiding. So we're seeing, for example, a really disturbing increase in hate crimes against Palestinian and Arab communities, and an enormous increase in those anti-Semitic attacks as well. It's just awful to see that both of these communities are unfairly persecuted. There is just a real chaos in our world right now. And I hope that the belief that chaos comes before the calm, I hope that that plays out at some point. Because it seems like right now there is a whole worldwide need for empathy, understanding, informed dialogue, and resolution. Resolution. Because children dying, no matter where in the world, is a blight on humanity, full stop. That little boy deserves to be living his life freely in America. Instead of his life being snuffed out at the tender age of 6 years old by a man that he believed was once somebody he considered a grandpa. I'd love to know your thoughts on this case, guys. It is a tough one, isn't it? But when it comes down to it, it's where politics overspill into a world of innocence and destroy that world of innocence. See you again next time. Hope you're all okay. Sending you lots of love. Be safe. And be loving. Let's be loving. More and more loving.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.